Hi, I'm Karen Hartgroff, and this is It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. We'll be talking with one of my favorite doctors, Dr. Michael Greger. Before we get to that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the week. I had an opportunity yesterday evening to talk to a group at a retirement community in California. And it was really inspiring to be with these people and to see that some of them, even at an older age, are interested in what's going on with the community and want to make changes not only in their own lives but the lives of their families. And a lot of times when I meet vegetarians, usually, well, in my experience, I don't want to say it's all the time, but a lot of children influence their parents to become vegetarian. But in one instance, I met this one woman. I believe she was in her 80s, and she looked fabulous. And she was working on her children to become vegetarian, and it was really very inspiring. Well, I've got Dr. Michael Greger on the line, I believe. Are you there? Michael, are you with me?
I believe so.
Oh, you are there. Okay. I wanted to introduce you, and I'm looking for my little information. Here we go. Okay. The wonderful Dr. Michael Greger is a founding member of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He's a physician, author, and internationally recognized speaker on nutrition, food safety, and public health issues. He has lectured at the Conference on World Affairs, the International Bird Flu Summit, the National Institutes of Health, testified before Congress, and was invited as an expert witness in the defense of Oprah Winfrey in the infamous meat defamation trial. He's a graduate of Cornell University School of Agriculture and Tufts University School of Medicine, and he serves as the Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. And that's just a little bio. This man is amazing. Not only are you committed to this mission of eliminating cruelty and pain and suffering to all life on Earth and keeping people healthy, but you're constantly giving. I know you donate a lot of what you make to organizations you believe in, and you live a very simple, simple, beautiful life. You walk the walk, and my hat's off to you, Dr. Greger.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. So, okay, we'll bounce around. We'll talk about a lot of things today. So I've seen a few clips of you with the recent swine flu epidemic. CNN, they've had you on a few times. And the first thing that amazes me is the other, quote, expert that they always have on. When you talk and you rattle off all of this brilliant information, the other person always looks like, if you excuse my expression, a deer in headlights. And then they try and fumble and come up with some sort of counter argument, and I have not been impressed. But have
my favorite,
you?
My favorite example of that was I was debating the. Well, I forget her title. She was like the head of science or the scientific advisor for the Pork Producers Council.
Mm-hmm.
I was debating her on a local DC station, and she got so flustered. In fact, you can even see, I mean, her hands are trembling. I mean, I felt sorry for her. This is a tough time to be a swine scientist, obviously. Not that there's any time where necessarily the science is on your side, but and she got so flustered that, you know, because I was, you know, talking about how the factory farms are the origins of this and many other serious human diseases. And she said, we don't know where this virus came from. It could have come from a hedgehog, she said. It wasn't necessarily a pig. It could have been a guinea pig, she says. And then instantly, because she's a veterinarian, she had a veterinary background, you know, realizing that, you know, guinea pigs, I don't even believe they get influenza, that
right.
She backpedaled very quickly. Poor thing.
Yeah, well, there's a lot I don't understand about many of my fellow human beings, and I don't understand, especially those that are so educated, veterinarians of all people, how they don't see the soul in all animals and how they can continue to encourage the treatment that goes on and factory farming. I just don't understand it. But we continue. So what's the state of swine flu at the moment?
Well, flu activity has been going down over the last 3 weeks. The concern, though, is next month or 2 months in September when kids go back to school, whether we'll see a dramatic spike. I mean, already this is very unusual to have so much flu during the summer season when it's so hot and so humid. We expect it only in the southern hemisphere at this point, but swine flu has not gone away, despite all kind of predictions aside. But, you know, that's what influenza viruses do, is they kind of break all the rules. So we're not sure what's going to happen with swine flu. There's, estimated over 1 million people already infected in the United States. There's been hundreds of deaths. The concern, the greatest concern is really, the parallels with the 1918 pandemic, which is the deadliest plague in human history, that also had this kind of mild spring-summer wave, almost unnoticed, but then came back in the fall of 1918, in the October, here in North America, to, wipe out 50 to 100 million people around the world. And so we know that they come in waves. We don't know where we are in this pandemic cycle, but certainly with this new virus to which there's no pre-existing human immunity, we're very concerned about this upcoming flu season, and already we're seeing some significant delays in vaccine production capacity, and so we could be in for a rough ride.
Yes. Now, which one is this particular one? I know there's all these H5s and N1s and different configurations.
So this is an H1N1 virus. It's actually a triple hybrid mutant. It is a very kind of rare combination of both a pig flu virus, human flu virus, and avian or bird flu virus. The first triple hybrid mutant to be described was here in North America. 1998, and actually the genetic fingerprint of this virus has been published, and the CDC has confirmed that the main ancestor of the current pandemic virus was this triple hybrid mutant virus that emerged on factory farms in the United States more than 10 years ago, and then very rapidly, within months, by early 1999, had infected 100% of the herds tested in Iowa and Illinois, 90% of the herds in Kansas and Oklahoma. This is not the first virus to emerge from factory farms, and unless we start giving these animals a little breathing room, it may not be the last.
Do you like saying triple hybrid mutant?
Triple reassortment virus.
It's such a sci-fi type of phrase that you'd hear in some of these action movies, triple hybrid mutant, but it's here, and it's here today, and it's with us, and it's intimidating. So how does this thing come about? Do you want to describe the awful conditions that go on that encourage this sort of thing to evolve?
Well, factory farms are breeding ground for diseases for a number of reasons. The sheer numbers of confined animals. With so many animals, stressed, deprived, suffering from poor welfare, overcrowded on today's factory farms, pathogen can really kind of run rampant and mutate among so many kind of confined hosts. Also, the unnatural stocking density, it's not just the number of animals, but how we pack them in. Swine flu is transmitted just like human flu via infected nasal secretions, respiratory droplets. So when pigs are intensely confined on factory farms, the large viral loads necessary for the emergence of these really rare flu mutants can rapidly transfer from one animal to another when they're kind of packed in snout to snout.
Mm-hmm. I always have that image of the movie that Dustin Hoffman was in, Outbreak, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. and they're in. Did you see that movie?
Yes.
They're in a movie theater, and someone sneezes, and they show the spray and how it's being breathed in from everyone else, and that's in a movie theater and in factory farms. I mean, animals don't even have that amount of space, so you can imagine how quickly they're going to infect each other.
And the stress crippling their immune systems is also a very important factor. You know, these breeding sows are confined in what are called gestation crates, these veal crate-like metal stalls where they can't even turn around. And their health suffers immensely. In fact, the first hybrid virus picked up in 1998 was on one of these swine gestation crate factory farms in North Carolina. Which is really no surprise. It's, you know, when we crowd more pigs like this, there's more of this kind of direct nose-to-nose contact, greater aerosol spread. And then, of course, a lack of adequate fresh air. The dankness helps keep the virus alive. The decaying fecal waste. I mean, there's millions of gallons of excrement. When a typical facility can have 5,000 animals, and so the excrement decomposes, releasing ammonia, burning the pig's respiratory tracts, which may predispose them to infection in the first place. The lack of adequate sunlight. In factory farms, there may be no sunlight at all, and the UV rays in sunlight are actually quite effective in destroying the influenza virus. 30 minutes of direct sun completely inactivates the hardiest flu virus which we know of, that H5N1 bird flu, yet it can last for days in the shade or weeks in moist or liquid manure. That's another key factor of the way we now raise animals, leading them to become these kind of breeding grounds, this kind of perfect storm environment for the emergence and spread of new so-called super strains of influenza.
Now, you wrote a book on the bird flu influenza, and where are we with that? That came out a few years ago, and we all were quite panicked about where that might go. Has that quieted down?
Well, so the H5N1 avian influenza virus, the reason we continue to be so concerned about it is because of the human lethality. The concern about swine flu is the human transmissibility. So swine flu is very transmissible. In fact, it has infected over 1 million Americans, we estimate at this point. Yet, it is relatively mild. It's only killed a few hundred people. Bird flu, the H5N1, is really the opposite. It's only infected hundreds of people, but it has killed over half the people it's infected. The case fatality rate's about 60%. In Indonesia, the hottest spot, maybe more like 80%. So you don't even get a coin toss as to whether or not you live through this disease. And so that's why we were always concerned about H5N1. And of course, right now, the worst case scenario would be that the H1N1 swine flu reassorts, recombines with the H5N1 bird flu, and
whoa,
this could happen. This could happen in Egypt. This could happen in Indonesia, in China, any of these places where we have infection of pigs reported with both the bird flu and the swine flu. In fact, that's why Egypt wiped out its entire pig population. They went and culled the entire country's population because they know they have the H5N1. And should one pig get sick with both viruses, we could.
Game's over.
That's where you get these kind of wild, you know, speculations about the kind of the Armageddon virus, these kind of things. But Dr. Robert Webster, the world's leading flu scientist, has, you know, talked about this. What they're doing now, the CDC is going to try it in a lab. They have a biosafety level 4 lab where they do Ebola and these other things down in Atlanta. And they're actually going to, in a lab, try combining the bird flu and swine flu and see what happens, just to kind of see if it's even kind of biologically possible. And there's been a lot of controversy whether or not that those experiments should even be done. But
exactly. That's scary. Sounds like another movie where a terrorist comes in and steals the deadly combined virus and starts to infect the world, right?
So that's why bird flu is very still much part of the story. It's what's called kind of panzootic, meaning it's kind of around the world. It's not North America, but it's in 60 countries around the world, still infecting millions. Has it so far infected hundreds of millions of birds, but again, very few people. And so, thankfully, this virus has not kind of adapted to humans so it can efficiently transfer from one person to another, whereas swine flu, almost immediately, as soon as it came up, instantly spread just like seasonal flu. Thankfully, it's mild, but we have no guarantee it'll stay mild for the future.
Well, you know, here it is, the Earth is doing everything it can to tell us that factory farming is a bad thing. So we're getting all of these potentially deadly flu viruses. We've got global warming. We've got greenhouse gas emissions, methane gas from factory farms that's destroying the entire environment, affecting all of our weather patterns. We've got hurricanes and tornadoes and tsunamis and droughts and floods. And the Earth is really revolting. And then on top of that, we've got record amounts of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and all of those food-related chronic diseases. When are people going to get it?
It's interesting. If one looks back at the what are called the major epidemiological transitions, the major periods of human disease, the first started about 10,000 years ago with the domestication of farm animals. That's when we got measles, and that's when we got many of the kind of great plagues of humankind. Started only about 10,000 years ago when we brought these animals into the barnyard. They kind of brought their diseases with them. And then the second major period of human disease was the Industrial Revolution, when we started slowly seeing this epidemic of cancer and heart disease and obesity and diabetes. And now, starting really just since about the mid-1970s, we've entered what medical anthropologists term the third, or what's called the Age of Emerging Plagues, this third epidemiological transition, whereas this unprecedented emergence, at least one new virus a year. Swine flu is not our only new disease. There's bird flu and mad cow and Ebola and all these new diseases never before described in human medicine over the last kind of 30 years. And if you think about it, every one of these three major periods of, these major surges in human disease has to do with our relationship with animals, and particularly animals raised for food, whether it was domesticating them about 10,000 years ago, whether it was eating so many of them just in the last few centuries, or in the last few decades, what we've done in terms of intensification of animal agriculture and destruction of habitat to feed this kind of meat-hungry diet, our meat-obsessed world, has led to kind of this third area. And, you know, it's not just swine flu. It's just one of the many deadly human diseases traced to these factory farming practices. You know, we all know the story very well of how the meat industry took natural herbivores, cows and sheep, turned them into carnivores and cannibals by feeding them slaughterhouse waste, blood, and manure. Then they took downed animals, too sick to even stand or walk, and fed them to people. And now, you know, people die of mad cow disease. In 2005, China, the world's largest pork producer, suffered this unprecedented deadly outbreak of an emerging pig pathogen called Strep Suis, which causes meningitis and deafness in people handling infected pork products. The World Health Organization blamed the intensive confinement conditions, which now is not only here in the industrialized Western world, but increasingly in the developing world, in particularly India, Brazil, and China. Pig factories in Malaysia birthed one of the deadliest of human pathogens called the Nipah virus, contagious respiratory disease causing these relapsing brain infections, killing 40% of people infected. Again, emergence blamed on factory farms. Here in the United States, the pork industry feeds pigs millions of pounds of human antibiotics every year just to promote growth and prevent disease in such a stressful, unhygienic, crowded environment. And now there are these multi-drug-resistant bacteria, and we as physicians are running out of good antibiotic options. And so, whether it was the study published this year found that half of the pigs tested in Iowa and Illinois were positive for MRSA, this so-called superbug, which kills more people in the United States than AIDS does every year, or in the Philippines, just last month, published in the most prestigious scientific publication, the World Science Magazine, the now realizing that pigs can be a host for Ebola, these pigs in the Philippines infected with Ebola. You see this trend here of how we treat animals. can have truly global public health implications?
Well, the thing is, we're not hearing about it enough. And you just rolled off a whole bunch of nightmares, and we're still continuing with this. I don't get it.
Well, it's very clear in the public health community has been warning about the risks posed by factory farms for years. It was always over 5 years ago, 2003, the American Public Health Association, which is the largest association of public health professionals in the world and also the oldest, they called for a factory farm moratorium, no more factory farms. In 2005, the United Nations warned that factory farms, in their words, could provide ideal conditions for the flu virus to mutate into more dangerous forms. And just last April, the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production, which was chaired by a Kansas governor, included a former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, concluded that factory farms pose what they called unacceptable public health risks.
Do you know any of these people?
And
I'm asking because I wonder, what are they eating? Are these people that are saying we should end factory farming, or at least not do it in the way it is today, are they eating food from these factory farms?
I know them, but I haven't eaten lunch with them.
I ask because, one way these things are going to end is if people just stop purchasing food from these sources. And because that's the fastest way to get anything done. I don't believe things get done by changing laws. Things get done when people don't spend money on these things. And so I'm wondering, these people that are saying these things, what are they eating? I just don't think they're vegan.
And by changing what one eats, it's easier to change those laws. I mean, it's the
economic
power.
It's the fastest, easiest thing to do.
And we're all empowered to actually do something about it. There's for so many social and public health ills in the world, there's very little we can do as individuals, as citizens. But for this issue, we can do something about it three times a day.
That's right. So here's a personal question. You're buried in all of this dung, no pun intended, or yes, pun intended. And how do you stay inspired and positive?
Well, I am I'm privileged to work here at the Humane Society of the United States, where we have built up really this kind of dream team of professionals over the last few years. And so I'm just so privileged to be inspired by the people I work with. So I work with, Paul Shapiro, founder of Compassion Over Killing. My boss is Mian Parker, former president of Compassion Over Killing. I mean, these are some of the kind of greatest minds in the movement. And I don't just get to live in the same city, but I actually get to interact with these people, kind of day in, day out. And so it's kind of a feedback loop. We inspire each other. And I know a lot of people don't have, may not have that kind of community of support, which they can reflect upon every day. And I have that, thankfully. And don't know how I really kind of get by without it, but we're each kind of pushing each other to do our best, remind each other why we're here, and what originally motivated us to get involved in the first place.
Well, that's really important because it's really easy when you're focusing on all of that. I tend to stray away from the ugly part because I just find it very difficult. Occasionally, I read a book that's sent to me to review for EarthSafe. I was just reading one by Stephen Wise about the pig production in North Carolina. And very, very difficult reading and depressing, and it's just, it's hard. When I start reading that information, somehow I go into another dimension and I feel like I'm connecting with all of the desperate animal spirits and I start feeling their angst. It's not a pretty place. But we're really grateful for everything you're doing. So I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Greger. Michael Greger has a website, drgreger.org. Drgreger.org, and that's drgreger.org. Wonderful information up there. Okay, so let's move to maybe a little lighter topic, and that's nutrition. And I was flabbergasted when I got my new issue of Ode magazine. Are you familiar with that magazine?
Only peripherally.
Yeah,
I've heard of it, but I don't think
I enjoy it. It's the magazine for intelligent optimists. And they talk about a lot of wonderful things that are going on all over the world. So I find it inspiring, and I prefer to read about all of the wonderful, positive things that are going on in the world. But the front of their cover, this last issue, was Fat, It's Where It's At, and they were talking about how fat is important and healthy in the diet, which I agree it is, but then they kind of misinterpreted what they called new research, I believe, and they said, so, you know, go ahead and have your bacon and butter and blue cheese, and they had these pictures of all these foods in the article, and I was horrified. So you're on top of all the latest research. What have you heard recently about fat?
Sure. So every year I review, all the, essentially every issue of every English language nutrition journal on the planet. There's about 5,000 peer-reviewed scientific publications on human nutrition every year, and that's kind of what I do as a hobby, nights and weekends. And
that's a nice hobby. Yeah.
And I mean, I used to just do it for my own benefit, just because I enjoyed it and wanted to stay on top of the research. But then, starting a few years ago, I started putting it all together and came out with a series of DVDs, kind of one every year, reviewing the last 12 months' science. And of course, all of the proceeds from all my books and DVDs and everything all goes to charity. There was a lot of very interesting things on fat recently. So for my 2009. DVD series, which just kind of came out, and what it showed was that fat certainly has a important role to play. So they measured the levels of antioxidants, for example, within these study subjects' blood for a period of 10 hours after they ate a big salad. And they did that with kind of a full fat dressing, a reduced fat dressing, and then a fat free dressing. You do that with a full fat dressing, and you see this huge, this big bell curve of your antioxidants spiking up and then coming down or over a period of 10 hours. And you do that with a reduced fat dressing, you really have a blunted curve, and you do that with a fat-free dressing, and there was essentially no change. It's like you didn't even eat the salad in the first place.
Mm.
None of those nutrients got into the bloodstream, and really it's not what you eat, it's not what we eat, it's what we absorb. And many of the nutrients, these wonderful phytonutrients found in plant foods like salads, are fat soluble, and so one needs fat actually in the stomach kind of at the same time for these nutrients to get absorbed. Of course, oil is not good for you, it's just a lot of empty calories, but whole plant foods like avocados and nuts, or pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, wonderful additions to one salad, and one really doesn't need a lot of fat. So, for example, 6 walnut halves for a big salad is all the fat one needs to maximize one absorption. Similarly, a quarter of an avocado, enough. That's all the fat you need to get all those wonderful nutrients. So fine, use a fat-free dressing, but just make sure that there's some kind of fat, and certainly those that use soy, that's another healthier source of fat that can be on one salad, or you can eat the salad in conjunction with something that has fat in it. So yes, it's important to get fat into our diet, but it should come from whole plant foods.
Isn't that amazing, though, how science is continually misconstrued? People jump on a soundbite and then use it to promote whatever it is they're about, and everybody gets confused.
One of my favorites from this year, I mean, exactly speaking to you know what you just said, was this study last summer that tofu linked to dementia. Do you remember this?
And it made headlines. The study in Hawaii?
This was a study done in Indonesia. So Fox News had this big, headline, eat soy, you get dementia. But had the journalists actually read the study?
They have to read that.
actually look at the science itself. you'll see that, indeed, in the study, tofu was related to dementia, but not tempeh, which is kind of, so it's not the soy. And the question really, well, what do they put in their tofu in Indonesia? And if you read the study, it says it's the Indonesian Department of Health saying that formaldehyde added as a preservative in tofu. And when I give presentations, I actually show pictures of it. It's like day glow yellow, because the street vendors just sell it for days. You know, they have to have it out in this tropical sun. And so they add this neurotoxic carcinogen formaldehyde to tofu, but not tempeh. And so, surprise, surprise, people that ate lots of formaldehyde. So the headline should have been, people eating formaldehyde suffer cognitive decline, suffer dementia. But of course, that's not what, and it just shows, and in fact, if one looks at science from around the rest of the world, soy actually appears to improve cognition. So, again, you know, it's important to look beyond the headlines and, you know, actually do a little background detective work yourself.
Yeah, but we're in a soundbite society, and people are not about reading or following through, and they're just about hearing the blips that they hear and going with it. It's really unfortunate.
That's why the work that we both do is so important.
That's right. But anyway, you know, what I find is that the things that are best for us are really the things that taste the best, at least when you get to a point where your tongue isn't numbed by too many fats and salt, and your tongue can actually taste food. An ideal salad for me is a salad that has raw nuts and seeds and made with a dressing with avocado. I love to cut up a little avocado with some tomato and then some cilantro and lime juice, and it's fabulous.
You're making me hungry.
And, you know, I'm at a point where if I eat a dressing that has the oil really coats your tongue. It's too intense. And people are always surprised, you probably get this too, when I tell them to avoid all oils, even olive oil, and that the Mediterranean diet is not a healthy diet. It's just maybe a little better than the sad standard American diet.
Well, the traditional Mediterranean diet was significantly better than the sad diet, and that's because it was based on fruits and vegetables and plant foods, and minimize the intake of animal foods. And so rather, and people think of the Mediterranean diet as being an olive oil, but no, I mean, it was a much more plant-based diet, and so no wonder when people go on that kind of diet, they can significantly drop their cardiovascular risk. But if you really want to get it down, then you really need to continue to move in that direction towards an exclusively plant-based diet, which is really...
Yeah, well, that's another thing where sound bites are misconstrued, because people are pouring gallons of olive oil thinking, oh my God, Mediterranean diet, olive oil, healthy, healthy, healthy. And that's not true.
Well, I mean, if you're going to use oil, certainly extra virgin olive oil, you can actually smell it still has some plants in there. It still has
right,
some
nutrients. Right, you smell the fruitiness if it's really good.
There's actually something in there besides just all the kind of empty calories. And so if you're going to use oil, there's no reason you need to use oil. And there's a way, and by using whole foods, you're getting much more kind of, you know, bang for your buck, you're getting more nutrients per calorie in terms of kind of nutrient density of one's food. And, you know, in our society, most people are really struggling with a weight issue. And so you want to make sure that you get as many nutrients per calorie as possible. And so oils and fats in general, really not the way to go.
Okay, so I've heard this thing about needing to eat some sort of fat to get the nutrients in the greens. And so I'm a big fan of green juicing. And do I need to eat some fat after or before I have a green juice in order to absorb all those precious nutrients?
You really do. And so people do it in different ways. So if you, for example, made your kind of green smoothie with...
It's not a smoothie. What I usually do is juice and... without the fiber. I get plenty of fiber from everything I eat, but I'm really into nutrient cramming.
So, I mean, so it's all about kind of having it in your digestive tract at the same time. So, you know, if you had a handful of nuts when you're chucking down that juice,
that would be better.
That's all you'd need, and it would definitely be better. In fact, I mean, there's so much nutrition In juice greens. In fact, there's probably more nutrition than anything else on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You'd hate to lose any of that. You know, you want it in your bloodstream, not in the sewer stream. And so it's important to make sure that you have fat in your stomach at the same time. And again, you know, the best way to do that is nuts, seeds, and
I don't have a problem with that. I love eating raw nuts.
And
there's
you plenty are of healthier for it.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's really good to know. Okay. Now, on this is a very popular topic. Talk about it all the time. But the things that vegans and vegetarians need to be concerned with, there's a lot of studies that show we get benefit in longer life and heart disease and all that stuff, but there's a few items that really we struggle with that cause us to have some problems, like B12 and omega-3s.
B12 is the big one. In fact, we continue to see year after year, in fact, every time I do these reviews, they keep popping up. In fact, we even got a disease named after us this year. Called vegetarian's myelopathy, which is essentially a B12 deficiency disease, where one can run into really kind of serious neurological problems, and it's all because of this not getting enough vitamin B12, which is a vitamin not made by plants, but it's not made by animals either. It's made by tiny microbes that blanket the earth. We probably used to get all we needed drinking out of a mountain stream or well water, but now we chlorinate our water supply to kill off the bacteria, so we don't get a lot of B12 in our water anymore. We don't get a lot of cholera either, so that's a good thing. and so in this kind of hygienic world, in a sanitized world, which again is a very good thing, unless one is eating bacteria-laden animals and products from those animals, one needs to get their B12 somewhere. And so the safest way to get it is to get it through B12 supplements or B12 fortified foods. Most of the breakfast cereals is a B12 fortified nutritional yeast, or one can take a tiny little tab of 2,000 micrograms of B12 once a week and never have to worry about it ever again. But it is important for people eating plant-based diets to make sure they get a regular, reliable source of B12, because it's just, think how far one of these headlines puts us back when we see a particular child who doesn't start out with very low B12 stores. You know, if you have a meat eater who then goes vegetarian or vegan, they have a little buffer within their liver. They have some stores built up. But particularly for pregnant, breastfeeding women and small children who may not have the buildup of B12 stores, they can run into problems very quickly unless they get B12. But it's just so easy, and you can't get too much of it. You just pee it right out. It's cheap, about $5 a year. Get all the B12 you need. And that's kind of your ticket to get all the amazing benefits in terms of, astoundingly low, obesity rates and diabetes rates and heart disease, some types of stroke, some types of cancer. That's the one kind of Achilles heel, but it's just because, we aren't eating, bugs, dirt, and feces anymore, but that's a good thing.
But it's so frustrating, because here's the one thing that might be considered a downside, and it's not really, because it's so easy to manage, but that's what the media always jumps on, whereas you've got so many children that are obese and have adult-onset diabetes at an early age, all because of their horrendous animal food-laden diets. And it's just not fair.
This is the first generation, estimated by the CDC, to actually live shorter lives than their parents.
Right.
We are now entering this age. And so, they don't call it adult onset diabetes anymore. Now we call it type 2 diabetes, with a recognition that we're now seeing it in children. There's been a 90% increase over the last 10 years in diabetes rates. I mean, and people don't, unless you have someone with diabetes in your family, you don't understand what diabetes means. Diabetes means limb amputations, means dialysis, means blindness. I mean, it means gangrene. I mean, it's a truly horrible disease. If people think that, they, you know, it's too hard to get enough exercise now. You know, try it with one foot.
Yeah. And it's what's so sad is that it is preventable and reversible.
Exactly. Preventable,
but,
treatable,
but it's not
reversible without
to grow back a limb.
Exactly. So you got to catch it early, and ideally you'd prevent it in the first place. It is, you know, it is a disease of a bad diet. It's like diverticulosis and any of these other diseases. I mean, it's a disease of fiber deficiency. It's a disease. And when we think of deficiencies, you know, when the media says, you know, what are vegans deficient in? No one asks the meat eaters what they're deficient in. And they're deficient 5, maybe 7 nutrients in many studies in terms of the average American compared to, you know, the very few nutrients that vegans, vegetarians would run into problems with. And you have to ask, well, wait a second. Where are the meat eaters getting their fiber? Where are they getting their vitamin C,
mm-hmm.
only found in plant foods? And where are they getting their, you know, their folate and their phytonutrients and many of the minerals found in, you know, in greens and beans and nuts? I mean, it's you know, we have a very nutrient-poor, calorie-rich diet in the United States, and we're, you know, seeing the diseases that, you know, we're suffering with.
Now, some meters have a problem with B12, too. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I mean, the vast majority of people with B12 deficiency are meat eaters over the age of 50. So the American Academy of Neurology says that everybody after the age of 50 needs to take, you know, B12 fortified foods or B12 supplements, because we just gradually lose our ability to absorb B12. And so there's actually kind of an epidemic of B12 deficiency among our elderly. And so it's just we take those same recommendations for getting B12 in our diet, and we just move them earlier, and so, you know, at any age we should all be getting our vitamin B12. But it's a real problem and can cause depression and all sorts of problems, increase our stroke risk, our heart disease risk. It can cut down on some of the vegetarian advantage, our kind of natural advantages, eating a plant-based diet. And so if we want to maximize the potential, we really do need to make sure that we get vitamin B12 in our diets. And the Framingham offspring study, for example, showed that many meat eaters, even in their 30s and 40s, are B12 deficient. And that study, the people with the best B12 status weren't the people eating meat, dairy, and eggs. It was the people eating breakfast cereal. Just because you know, all the breakfast cereals, Raisin Bran, cornflakes, you know, they all have B12 added to them.
Right.
So those are the ones that had good B12 status. We're finding out that, you know, animal products are not such good sources. After all, a very small percentage of the B12 is actually bioavailable. So it's really a good idea for everyone to get their B12 from a safe, reliable source, and that's B12 fortified foods or supplements.
Yes. So are you coming out with a new book in the future? Are you working on anything interesting right
now?
Well,
I should have a swine flu DVD out in the next month or so.
Mm.
I'm trying to get this, and that's really been my focus over the last few months, because fearing a resurgence in the fall, I want to make sure that we have resources available.
Yes.
So DVD, I'm working on, you know, a peer-reviewed manuscript for a scientific publication. And then maybe we'll do another book, although I've been tending to kind of move away from my outreach to kind of the general public and really more towards kind of the specialized scientific and policy world. So publishing instead of, you know, kind of lay audience books, you know, publishing in the peer-reviewed scientific literature, and that seems to... you know, I'm able to then speak at these medical conferences, scientific conferences, and really kind of move the message really within the, you know, kind of public health fields and the ones that get to kind of make these decisions. And so,
talking to the mainstream rather than the choir.
Right. So, I've been thinking about kind of doing a, you know, flu factories book, talking about the swine flu. I think I'm going to put it kind of in DVD form, since I have a presentation that I'm just wrapping up this week, and so it's easy to just burn down DVD, and keep an eye out for that on my website.
I will. That's great. Now, you mentioned it briefly about the the vaccines that there might be, and we're behind in production. Are there any for the current swine flu or the other more dangerous bird flu?
Well, I mean, every vaccine manufacturer on the planet has been working full steam on coming up with a swine flu vaccine. And we're just finding that the yields for these vaccines are just not what we were hoping for. And the reason is because we're growing these vaccines in chicken eggs. And this is a pig virus that doesn't grow very well in bird eggs. And so there's been pressure to move to more advanced cell-based techniques which don't involve chicken eggs, and so we don't have to deal with this kind of problem. And so it's not that we won't have vaccine. We're just not going to have enough of it, unfortunately. And so the first batches may be commercially available as early as mid-October, but if we start, I mean, if we see a peak in September, we're kind of going to be kind of left hanging. You know, ideally we'd have an effective vaccine in place such that should there be a spike in cases, particularly if there was an increase in virulence, if we started seeing more people dying from the disease, we'd be able to roll out very quickly and efficiently, you know, tens of millions of doses, and that's just not going to happen. So mid-October is our most optimistic at this point, but, you know, we may not have enough till even the beginning of next year. Now, the virus may hold off till then. In fact, may not really get serious until next year. But, you know, we'd really like to have it in place. And, of course, for most of humanity, particularly in the global south, they have no vaccine, period. And they will have no vaccine because we have all the, you know, we in Europe have all the vaccine production capacity. And the World Health Organization has been begging these companies to donate just 10% of the vaccines they're making for the developed world to the bulk of humanity, to the billions of people that will never see vaccine, but they haven't even done that.
Right.
So we can just kind of hope that this virus is not going to get more serious than it already is, but if it's not this virus, it'll be some virus in the future. And so what we really need is not, you know, vaccines and antiviral drugs and all these kind of secondary prevention measures. We need to say, wait a second, take a step back and say, where did this virus come from in the first place, and what can we do to prevent the emergence, the primary emergence of these viruses in the first place? And so that's where some of my work comes in with talking about the role of industrial animal agriculture in not only the evolution of this virus, but many of these other diseases.
So is Tamiflu not any good anymore?
We now have Tamiflu resistance for swine flu on three continents, and the seasonal flu is essentially completely resistant to Tamiflu. And so there's real concerns that resistance will build up so quickly that it won't be useful during the next pandemic. There are two drugs in that class, the so-called neuraminidase inhibitors, and Relenza, the other one, which is kind of a breathable Tamiflu. There hasn't yet to be a single case of resistance, so at this point that may be our best choice. And so the federal government is now buying up large stocks in the hopes in perhaps a year's time to have significant doses of that other drug. But at this point, whether or not there's a vaccine, the best thing we can do is to not get infected in the first place. And that's really just kind of, you know, everything you need to know to survive a pandemic you learned in kindergarten. You know, wash your hands, cover your nose and mouth when you cough or sneeze, not with your hands, with a sleeve, cough to your elbow, into your shoulder, into fabric, just so you don't contaminate your hands, which you then go on to contaminate a doorknob or light switch handle, gas pump handle, that kind of thing, that can allow this virus to go from one person to another, who then touches that doorknob and then touches their face, their eyes, nose, and mouth, their mucous membranes, and then can infect themselves that way. It's not only being in a room with someone coughing or sneezing, but, you know, touching something that someone who's coughed into their hand has touched, and then inadvertently, you know, picking your teeth or rubbing your eyes or something.
What about a strong immune system? Does that help?
Well, I mean, in terms of getting infected in the first place, that's exactly what we need, is strong immune systems. And so, for example, if someone, even with active tuberculosis, coughs in your face, there's really only about a 1 in 200 chance you'll come down with tuberculosis, and that's because we have an immune system. Assuming that you have a good immune system. I talk about this study in my 2009 DVD. This interesting sleep study where they took people, you know, they just dripped cold virus into people's noses. And you think, wait a second, you drip a virus into someone's nose, of course they're going to get sick. But no, only a small percentage of those people get sick, and all depends on how good their immune system is. So they drip the virus, they have people, you know, sleep 7 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours, who got the, you know, and they can do these studies and show, you know, what's the best things to do, to eat, to optimal sleep duration, to optimally build one's immune system. Unfortunately, once one actually gets this virus, a healthy immune system may actually, in some cases, do more harm than good, just because, as we saw, for example, in the 1918 pandemic, there seemed to be what's called the cytokine storm phenomenon, where essentially the virus just kind of triggers an overactive immune response, and so your own immune system attacks your lungs, such that when people die of either the 1918 flu or this new H5N1 bird flu, it's actually not the virus that kills you, but your own immune system.
That's
why the young, healthiest people were dying of those particular diseases. And currently, H1N1, the swine flu, the average age of infection is 18, and the average age of death is 22. People 22 years old should not be dying of the flu. And so these should be people with really robust immune systems. After about age 40, one's immune system starts to decline. And that's why typically seasonal flu tends to, you know, hurt the elderly or infants or people who are immunosuppressed. But this new flu, the swine flu, really does seem to be able to cause, in rare cases, serious illness in people, even with very robust immune systems. So again, the answer is to just not get infected in the first place. And that's really these common sense hygiene measures in terms of hand washing and respiratory hygiene.
That sounds pretty good. So I just want to, we're coming towards the end, and I want to talk about what I love to talk about, and that is food. And I want to know, at one point you told me you were trying to make a different dish every day and not repeat the same dish. Are you still doing something like that?
Oh, well, that's my beloved, that's the love of my life, who has this who has this carpe diem attitude towards food and towards life in general, and just thinks life is way too short to ever eat the same thing twice. Of course, that makes it difficult if you're the one making food in the house. You kind of run out of cookbooks, but thankfully the internet has come to my rescue, and there's just so many. I will never run out of recipes, and so I do enjoy a very varied, exciting, adventuresome diet. At the same time, you know, if I make something really good, it's kind of sad, because then you realize, oh, I'm never going to make it again. And so I used to have my old favorites, you know, that I just eat all the time, because I know I love them. And so I'm finding now, in this more adventuresome way of eating, I'm actually eating food that doesn't taste as good as my favorites. But then again, you never know. You'll come across something you never would have even tried that may be even better than everything I've always tasted. So, yes, I'm still trying all sorts of new fancy stuff. I've been doing some more raw foods. I got a dehydrator.
Wow.
I'm making sweet potato chips, which is kind of my current favorite, with date sugar and cinnamon.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Oh, delicious.
That's fabulous.
Making this fruit dip. That's what I just made yesterday, with just raw almond butter, some Dutch processed cocoa, and some date sugar, which is just pulverized whole dates, I think a little vanilla extract, and then to make it a little more liquidy, added some Earl Grey tea that has that nice little citrus note, and you whip it up, and you just have this dark, decadent, deep chocolatey spread, which I'm sure you can do a lot of things with, but I just dip apples in them, and that's my kind of new favorite thing. And again, it's whole foods, it's plant foods, and it's delicious, and so it's helping me eat more apples, which is something that all of us should do.
Don't the doctors say an apple a day
keeps people like me away, absolutely. and we're finding, in fact, in my 2009, I actually have a whole chapter on apples because we're finding just some amazing things. And so we talk about superfood. You know, it doesn't have to be some exotic berry from the Himalayas or the Amazonian jungle. Literally, apples can hold
organic
their own.
Apples.
Organic apples, cheap, simple, local in many places. Can really hold their own against, you know, any superfood you put up against it.
Well, yeah, I love them because it doesn't take much to curb your sweet tooth with an apple, and they make you feel full very quickly.
In fact, there's a study. They used both pears and apples and found that you take kind of overweight standard Americans and before each meal had them eat either an apple or a pear, and they significantly, and doing nothing else to their diet, they lost significant amount of weight because that wonderful pectin, that soluble fruit fiber in the apple or the pear kind of just fills up, kind of like a sponge-like mass in your stomach. So then when you sit down to actually eat a meal, you end up eating significantly less. And as a bonus, you're increasing the number of fruit servings every day. So that one simple measure cause significant weight loss. Of course, what we'd like to see them is eat more plant foods in general, but I think that's an excellent way to improve one's diet.
Well, Dr. Greger, it's been great talking with you. The hour has just flown. We've learned so much, and the bottom line is you can eat a healthy vegan diet, plant-based diet, every day and never repeat the same meal. Lots of variety, lots of delicious, diverse, different things you can eat, and keep eating your apples. Check out Dr. Greger's website, drgreger.org. And thank you again. This has been It's All About Food. We'll be back next week with Joe Stepaniak. And we'll be talking about compassionate living and vegan cuisine. Be well. Thank you so much.